bad. Finally, warming up to his new bandmates, Morrison told them stories of touring with them. At the Roller Dome, Morrison, Bebo, and Kilbanya drank beers in the van, while Sheldon and the roadies set up. A cop knocked on the window. It was against the law to sit and drink in a parked car. He pulled them out of the van for questioning in front of a line of kids waiting to get in to see them play. The manager kicked up a fuss, asking if the cop knew that the man in the van was a star. The cop said he didn't care if they were the Beatles. The promoter brought up the fact that the police were getting paid to oversee a concert tonight, and if Van Morrison and his players were going to be arrested, there would be no show. Morrison fumbled through a mea culpa. "We didn't mean disrespect. We do it all the time back home." The police finally dropped the act, and the band rushed to the stage, where a throng of teenage girls had gathered. Bebo thinks Morrison was especially nervous during the incident with the cops because of deportation fears. The anxiety turned electric when the band started playing, sizzled like cooked bacon, per Bebo. When the band closed with Brown-Eyed Girl, the audience erupted. As the band exited the Roller Dome, one of the cops said, "Not bad." Packing up, Bebo saw Morrison do something odd. There were a few girls standing around, all teeny boppers, all young girls, and Van goes up to one of them and he whispers in her ear, and her eyes go wide, and she quickly walks away like she's scared. What did he say? Bebo doesn't know, but says he witnessed it a few times that summer. I'd see him go up to a young girl, whisper something, and it was always the same reaction, every single time. Everyone in the band agrees that, along with the Astral Weeks songs, both Moondance and Domino, future Morrison classics, were written and developed that same summer as well. According to guitarist Sheldon, he and Van first stumbled upon Domino at the Boston Tea Party, fooling around on stage before the audience was admitted. It was based on Sheldon playing a lot of treble on the guitar and playing something that sounded like Mona, the Rolling Stones' version of a Bo Diddley song. Morrison was on drums as Sheldon chimed out the chords. He swung this mic over and started singing, and the song came from there. As soon as he finished, he said, "That's a real motherfucker." Drummer Bebo confirms that the band performed an extended version of the song that, with young Sheldon's affinity for feedback, came off like a musical paroxysm. Sheldon also remembers messing around with a Grant Green song called Lazy Afternoon at one rehearsal. Morrison requested some alterations and began singing a melody that would eventually morph into the song Moondance. Kilbanya corroborates this version of events. His favorite moment from 1968 was playing Moondance for the first time in Cambridge. New song, same bass line ever since. The band was remarkably busy that summer, playing at rock clubs, roller rinks, high school gyms, amusement parks, and outdoor festivals. One former Wayland High School teacher and some of his former students patched together their memories of the evening. He threw a temper tantrum on stage about feedback. He was paid $400 for the performance, and someone stole his microphone after the show. Meanwhile, at the psychedelic supermarket, the Tea Party's dumpy competitor, Morrison tried to quit before playing the final set. Less than 10 people were in the audience, but owner George Papadopoulos demanded that they finish. Don Law recalled that when a long line started to form for a show at the psychedelic supermarket, Papadopoulos would actually take a ladder outside the venue, climb up to the marquee, and raised the posted price of admission to the audible groans of the gathered audience. Morrison countered that Papadopoulos had promised at least 100 people, a fact the club owner denied. Van exploded, packing as many F-words as he could into the next few short sentences, Bebo recalled. "I had never heard such an outburst at that point in my life." Bebo explains what happened next. Van, in a foul mood with his back to the small audience that had finally started to arrive, turned it into a stressful rehearsal, stopping us in the middle of the songs and changing the tempos halfway through the choruses. A young musician from Salem named Ed Morneau remembered this specific show, its sour atmosphere still shading his opinion of the singer to this day. He performed a few tunes, then walked off. People were pissed. I immediately disliked him, and still do. John Sheldon's overall memory of the entire summer is something akin to that night at the psychedelic supermarket. It was just on the edge of madness, he says. It's a miracle we played anywhere. It's a miracle we got to any gigs at all. The summer was littered with moments like these. For Morrison, a musician who had already thoroughly paid his dues, it must have been painfully humbling. After one club date, a mean-spirited audience member walked up to him and said, "You wrote that song, Brown Eyed Girl?" Morrison nodded. "When I first heard it on the radio," the guy told him, "I thought, man, the Rolling Stones have really gone downhill." Back to the Cape, this time at a church-like venue with atrocious acoustics. John was playing particularly loud and raucous, with a lot of out-of-tune chords and feedback, Bebo says. Sheldon started smashing Bebo's cymbals with the head of his guitar, apparently inspired by Pete Townsend's onstage theatrics. After the first set, Morrison disappeared into the dressing room and his Southern Comfort, while Bebo confronted Sheldon about his cymbal attack. Sheldon admitted he got carried away. But at the top of the second set, Sheldon started to once again hit Bebo's drums so aggressively that a cymbal stand crashed to the stage. Morrison whipped around, screaming, "It's too fucking loud!" Bebo stormed off the stage to yell at the guitarist, but couldn't find him. At last, opening a closet door, Bebo saw Sheldon inside, cutting his arm with a penknife. Bebo asked if he was crazy. Sheldon told him he was. "Okay, John," Bebo said, unsure how to proceed. "Your crazy act worked." But it wasn't an act. Though Sheldon doesn't recall this specific incident, laughing as I recount Bebo's tale, he doesn't doubt it happened. As a 15-year-old, John Sheldon had been committed to McLean Hospital, a psychiatric institution in Belmont, formerly known as Asylum for the Insane. "I was submitted in the spring of 1966, he says. "I got out in the fall of 1967. And I met Van a few months later." Years passed before Sheldon accessed his McLean files. He learned that the official diagnosis had been adolescent turmoil, and that the doctor's main goal had been to get him through his awkward years without hurting himself. Unlike the horror show of Bridgewater State Hospital, McLean was beautiful, with spacious grounds designed by Frederick Law Olmsted, who became a patient there 25 years later. "Everyone makes the same comment," Alex Beam writes in Gracefully Insane, his book about McLean. "It doesn't look like a mental hospital." The idea was simple. A calm, pastoral setting might help in easing a disturbed mind. Artists like Sylvia Plath, Ray Charles, and James Taylor, the songwriter who had taught Sheldon guitar basics as a kid, had all gone there. Sheldon learned to smoke pot at McLean. You could hide anything. You could get anything. Somebody was always going into town and coming back with something, the guitarist told Alex Beam. In a strange coincidence, after Sheldon stopped playing with Morrison, the man who stepped into his place, flute player John Payne, also happened to be a McLean alum. Payne's time at the hospital happened to overlap with that of his first cousin once removed, who was none other than the poet Robert Lowell. According to Payne's sister Sarah, the two relatives recognized each other on the grounds, but barely spoke in their medicated haze. "He was incredibly high and incredibly drugged," Payne reported to Sarah. "And even though he was talking to you, he was a million miles away. At the end of the eventful, traumatic Cape Cod show at the church-like venue, Morrison's band ambled back into the van to get back to Boston. On this particular night, their transportation had been arranged by Sheldon, not for the first time. When your 17-year-old guitar player that's living at home has to go arrange transportation, you probably aren't crossing all your T's, he jokes. Driving home, Sheldon smashed the rental into the back of a truck on the Southeast Expressway. No one was injured, but the van now had a gaping hole in the hood. The accident might help illuminate the opaque poem on the Astral Week's sleeve. Not only is it the album's only mention of time spent in Massachusetts, but it specifically names Hyannisport, the Cape Cod town where, by all available evidence, Van traveled to only twice, the second time being the show described above. The 11-line verse takes us from Hyannisport to Cambridgeport, where he and Janet lived. Is the Astral Week's poem about returning home to Janet after a particularly bad show down the Cape? Could the phrase bumper to bumper refer to the car accident? Morrison would loathe this kind of connect the dots. In 1985, he trashed the whole genre of lyrical analysis. People are saying, well, this means this about that, and he was going through that when he wrote this. So you get to the point where you're afraid to write anything because you know somebody's going to make something out of it. I'm very unanalytical about what I do. And yet Morrison himself has often recontextualized his own stories and lyrics over the years. Biographer Clinton Halen called him the master revisionist. Safely back in Boston, Van Morrison and the Controversy next opened for California soft rock band The Association at Frank Connolly's Carousel Theater in Framingham. Backstage, members of The Association excitedly talked to Morrison. They were in the know. When Morrison recognized a moment to be gregarious as advantageous to his career, he could turn it on without a problem. Much like when the DJs came backstage to talk to him, Joey Bebo recalled, Van was holding court. An hour later, about to go on stage, Bebo and Kilbanya commented on how nice the Association guys were. Morrison declared them to all be faggots. They opened with the long electric version of Domino. The crowd was polite. The subsequent Boston Globe Review noted that the group never really communicated. Even if it had been glowing, Morrison probably would have found fault with the assessment. Bebo once watched Morrison read a largely positive write-up, crumple up the paper, and call the writer an asshole. The gigs kept coming. The Cambridge Electric Ballroom, Hampton Beach Casino, an in-studio performance at Ray Reapin's new station, WBCN. The comic strip in Worcester. Morrison was in Boston to work, and the itinerary proves it. In August, the band played Rocky Point Amusement Park in Rhode Island. Bebo recalled thousands of people all there to see Van. The band tried to make their basement rehearsal gear work for the gigantic outdoor venue, to little effect. What's worse, Bebo busted the head of his snare drum on the first song. As it happened, none of that mattered. Van's voice alone could carry a show, and the crowd was in a frenzy. Bebo had caught wind that Morrison was promised a percentage of the admission fee for this concert, and forgetting all the nights Van had paid him $150 when he himself was barely paid, the drummer tried to lead an insurrection demanding a larger piece of the take. "They all came to see me," Morrison calmly explained, before walking away. "It was a lesson I never forgot," Bebo wrote in his memoir. "And from that moment on, I understood my place." Most of Van Morrison's Boston Electric Band agree on what happened at the beginning and middle of the summer, but memories diverge about the end. Did the Electric Band record anything together? There are certainly no live bootlegs even whispered about for this lineup. Peter Wolf's tape is of the acoustic, post-anti-electric dream trio, and the WGBH performance is Van backed by saxophone and Kilbanya on bass. According to Sheldon, someone from Bang Records came to Boston at the behest of Eileen Burns to induce Van to cut some new demos. A representative, sporting an out-of-date Beatle haircut and talking a lot about trendy bubblegum pop songs. He was sort of like an operator who wanted to get a little ditty out of us. It's true that Eileen Burns eventually forced Morrison to record his contractually obligated songs for Bang. The result was the infamous Nonsense or Revenge recordings. Sample titles, Ringworm, Wanted Danish, recorded in New York the following year. As absurd as the lyrics are, they seem to confirm Sheldon's memory of someone from Bang Records visiting Boston. This here's the story about Dum Dum George, who came up to Boston one sunny afternoon, he sings in Dum Dum George. In the track, Morrison wails about a record producer who brags about making lots of money and number one hits. Because many of these contractually obligated songs seem to specifically delight in making fun of Burt Burns and his old label, it's reasonable to assume that the dumb record producer who visited Boston was most likely working for Bang. In this session, regardless of who or what prompted it, they laid down the dirty, rocking, really good version of Domino and other new songs, though Sheldon has never heard them since. Bebo confirms that the band made some demos at Ace Recording Studios, but he recalls it being on Van's own dime, with the goal of wooing a new label. Along with Domino, they laid down a tune called Lorna. This wasn't like the gigs where everything was so loud and chaotic that he was just a thread in a wild tapestry of sounds barely audible through my own playing, Bebo wrote. It was the moment that I truly became aware of how good he really was. Bebo says that the Ace producer didn't think he was rock enough and brought in another local percussionist. You know Victor, the one-arm drummer? This was Victor Multi Moulton, of a garage band called the Barbarians. Multi had lost his left arm in an explosion at 14, and clutched his drumstick with a prosthetic claw. The Barbarians found minor fame with their two-minute exploration of androgyny, Are You a Boy or Are You a Girl? Their second biggest hit was Multi, in which the drummer talk-sang in a rich Boston accent, his personal story of overcoming teenage tragedy, on top of chords that sound a whole lot like Hang On Sloopy. While Multi was released by the Barbarians and landed the group back on the Billboard charts, it turned out Victor's backing band for the recording was The Band, as in The Band, who were smack dab in the middle of their turn backing Bob Dylan. The rest of the Barbarians were embarrassed by the single, and the band broke up the next year. Van needed a heavy drummer, Multi says, and I was definitely heavy duty. In Multi's memory, he declined Morrison's offer to join the band after this recording session. But according to Bebo, Morrison didn't care for Multi's bashing, and requested that Bebo be brought back. Herbert Yakis, half of the sibling team that ran Ace, says that a Van Morrison session, with or without Multi, would have been just another day's work compared with their usual clientele. Because of the eventual fight with his brother Milton over the royalties to Old Cape Cod, a hit for Patti Page in 1957 that originated at Ace, Yakis is at first reluctant to stir up the past. That song made Cape Cod, he yells at me. There were weird bookies paying for women to make records all the time, he recalls. I had a priest who fell in love with a woman singer. He took the church's money and paid me to cut a record with this woman. The problem was, when these songs went nowhere, they'd threaten me like it was my fault. Another time, a woman came in with a stack of records and told Yakis, when I die, I want you to play these records in this order as they prepare my body for burying at the morgue. he did. At one point, the studio even offered to install secret recording equipment in the rooms and cars of spouses who were suspected of cheating. Ace went belly up in 1971, and save for a few recordings that Herbert decided to take home, like a Louis Armstrong session, all of it went in the trash or to other studios to be taped over. How and why did the band shift from what Bebo calls a strictly electric sound to an acoustic approach in the weeks leading up to the September recording of Astral Weeks? Bebo contends that it was all because Kilbanya's instrument broke at one of the band's first Catacombs shows. The bass was sending nothing but electrical noise to his amplifier as an impatient Morrison watched from a nearby table. With no hope of fixing it, Kilbanya ran out of the club and into his nearby alma mater, Berkeley, to borrow an acoustic bass. Bebo claims they reworked some of the newer songs almost as if it was rehearsal. We played soft and jazzy behind Van's wailing vocals. What about John Sheldon's memory of Van's dream, the dream instructing him to stop using electric instruments? Bebo shakes his head. I have no idea where John's coming from, but I know he was this crazy kid. And he may have seen things a little differently, but nothing like that. Kilbanya remembers his bass crapping out on him, but doesn't recall this as being the accidental turning of the tide. He doesn't remember Morrison's dream, but he doesn't find it all that unlikely either. After all, later that fall in New York, Morrison would wake Kilbanya in the middle of the night to jam on a new song that had just come to him, in a dream about an electric radio. Sheldon doesn't waver. He recalls rehearsing without Joey and with just Tom and me on the acoustic guitar. It was very clear that Van didn't want any electric instruments. He admits that his memory of Van Morrison's dream sounds strange, but thinks it outrageous that he could have made it all up. I remember very clearly that he said that, and then, next thing I know, we were rehearsing acoustically. Another key figure disputes one of Sheldon's vivid memories. Producer Louis Merenstein denies ever calling Van Morrison a genius, at the Ace audition or elsewhere. Sheldon insists he heard it. But is there a chance it actually came from the mouth of Richard the manager? Or the Bang Records emissary? All the while, Van Morrison was writing and refining the songs that would end up on his 1968 masterpiece. Van was doing the tracks that were to become Astral Weeks, recalled Mick Cox, a guitarist who was recording in New York with his band Heir Apparent. I stayed up for 2 or 3 days in Cambridge, and recorded some stuff with him. Just fantastic music. By the end of the summer, the Van Morrison controversy was fraying, Sheldon says. The original manager, Richard, or Frank, was no longer there by August. The money was running out. Janet Planet does recall that the Boston manager wanted to charge Van an arm and a leg for every little thing he did. Soon after, Louis Merenstein came to Ace for the audition, and the guitarist understood he'd been politely removed from the band. Joey Bebo, of course, has a different memory. After the Ace demo sessions, the whole band sat in a semicircle as Van asked who would be staying on after the summer ended. Bebo had the distinct impression that something had happened over the week of cutting demo tapes. A record contract. John Sheldon told Van that he couldn't do it, as high school would be resuming, and Kilbanya immediately said yes. Bebo was the only one who asked to sleep on it. The first member of his family to attend college, Bebo agonized over the decision on a night walk through Boston. There was the Prudential, towering over the peaks of dozens of apartment buildings, he recalled. Suddenly, I felt small. I felt like I lived a charmed life. I didn't know who to thank, so I thanked God. He burst into tears. The next morning he told Van Morrison he would return to school in September. Hearing the music today, Bebo says he would have given it all up, all my education, to play with Van again. I just want to get back there. Unlike Joey Bebo, John Sheldon remained in the music world long after that summer. Immediately after the Morrison gig ended, Sheldon joined the local band, Bead Game, which surfaced in a lot of the Bosstown Sound coverage, though their first album didn't appear until after the scene's heyday. He went on to write songs that would be recorded by his old friend James Taylor. September Grass and Bittersweet both appeared on albums that went platinum for the singer-songwriter. Sheldon most recently has performed a piece called The Red Guitar, a reference to the Fender he bought off Taylor in the early 60s. I ask Sheldon if, looking back, he wishes he had some kind of writing credit for Domino or Moondance. If he could have anything, he says, it wouldn't be royalties, but the long-lost recording of Domino. The rest of the band didn't like it, he says, but that's the one that we wrote together. That's the one that rocked. The version we made together was rock and roll. It was awesome. I just wish that I had it. Tom Kilbanya, now retired and living happily with his wife in Chicopee, has similar feelings. In my whole life, this is all I got to offer, he tells me in his backyard, referring to his time playing bass for Morrison. This is it, he says, banging the picnic table for emphasis. Would hearing the recording of the Catacombs show be meaningful? Yeah, he says. I would freak out. With all the discrepancies between the memories of Morrison's Boston players, the tape would surely offer some clues as to whose version of events of the summer of 1968 is most accurate, as well as documenting the local contributions to the songs that would comprise Astral Weeks. But after our evening together, Peter Wolf has become unreachable, and the likelihood of my hearing his tapes has vanished. Chapter 8. A little more light into the darkness of man. Half a century of work has paid off. The houses on Fort Avenue Terrace, once dilapidated, are now gorgeous and homey. Inside number 5, each room has its signature artisan flair, such as ornate woodworking around a doorframe. Two family members, one of whom has lived here since the late 60s, are my guides. We walk through the connection and approach a long dining room table where 50 family members might be seated at Thanksgiving dinner. A framed picture of Mel Lyman hangs in many of the rooms. A page of his writing, mounted and displayed, decorates a narrow staircase in the back. On this day, residents are doing dishes, enjoying coffee, watching television. Meeting the older members, I rewind their faces by 50 years to figure out if they were once featured in an Avatar photo spread. Some people get introductions, others remain nameless. At one point, someone resembling a piano player and would-be bank robber Terry Bernhard waves hello from the kitchen. In the living room of another house, Mel Lyman's banjo rests in a chair by the window, as if enjoying the view of Highland Park and the tower. As we pass into the backyard, one of my hosts, a college professor named Randy Foote, plucks a grape off a vine on the trellis and pops it into his mouth. I do the same. With no fences to separate the lawns of the family's houses, Fort Avenue Terrace's backyard seems to go on forever. I realize that this place is a paradise for about a dozen baby boomers. The view is lovely and the grapes are free. Is this what the end game of a successful 60s commune looks like? If this is a happy ending, it's a hard-earned one. In their early years, the Fort Hill community harassed and frightened scores of people who crossed their path. Ex-members have taken the family to court, trying to claim their share of the communal wealth. That's to say nothing of Mel Lyman augmenting his natural charisma with LSD, wielding the drug to foster devotion. Michael Bowen, co-founder of San Francisco underground newspaper The Oracle, recognized this when he met Lyman out on the West Coast. Upon seeing footage of Lyman's psychedelic sessions, Bowen got a bad vibe. He was using LSD to turn these people into zombies, reprogramming them, Bowen said. We wanted none of that. In the late 50s and early 60s, Boston and Cambridge served as ground zero for both the folk music revival and the origin of the American hallucinogenic revolution. From Harvard Square, chemicals and chord progressions leaked into the ether, drifting westward through America, altering the culture along the way. The histories of both movements converge in Mel Lyman. While rock's psychedelically inclined songwriters receive most of the credit for diving into the alternate worlds opened by LSD, Lyman's saga is a reminder that the folk revivalists, nurtured by Professor Timothy Leary's hallucinogenic rebellion at Harvard, first took that leap into the unknown. Leary's explorations were often considered well-intentioned, if reckless. By contrast, Lyman's had an ulterior motive. Paula Press, all of 17 when she arrived at Fort Hill in 1968, recalled her LSD journey as arranged by Mel. He gives really strong doses, and I hallucinated and everything, she told Rolling Stone. He was growing horns. They were growing all over the room, and he was changing from various kinds of animals. Similarly, novelist Kay Boyle, who lived on the hill to be near her two children, was aghast when she listened to a tape of her daughter Faith Goode in the middle of an acid trip. I love you, I love you, this is so marvelous, Goode said hysterically. Oh, Mel, you are the most beautiful man. In his published writings about LSD, Lyman sounded more like Leary than a scary man sprouting horns. There is no reason to fear it. We created it because we need it. Like the electric light, he wrote in a dense 1967 essay. Everybody wants to know about it, and that is proof enough of its importance. LSD does what alcohol did when it was new, and what every new creation does. It lets a little more light into the darkness of man. It's no coincidence that Lyman's acid evangelism took root in Boston, the true birthplace of American hallucinogenic culture. The year was 1949. The location was the Boston Psychopathic Hospital on Fenwood Street, a mile and a half from Fort Hill. Dr. Otto Cauders, head of neurology and psychiatry at the University of Vienna, lectured on a new drug that mimicked mental psychosis. In the audience, Dr. Milton Greenblatt and Dr. Max Rinkel listened in awe as he described how a small dose had driven its inventor temporarily crazy. We were very interested in anything that could make someone schizophrenic, Greenblatt recalled. If doctors could cause temporary insanity with a medicine dropper, they might better understand how to treat their patients. Perhaps LSD-25 could even help cure schizophrenia. Rinkel arranged an order of LSD-25 to be shipped from Sandoz Laboratories in Switzerland to Boston. Neither Greenblatt nor Rinkel took the first dose of LSD in North America. For that, they turned to their boss, Dr. Robert Hyde. Rinkel gave Hyde a glass of water with 100 micrograms of LSD, less than half of inventor Albert Hoffman's initial accidental dose. Feeling no effect, Hyde insisted he be permitted to make his rounds. Rinkel trailed him, later reporting that he berated us and said the company had cheated us, given us plain water. That was not Dr. Hyde's normal behavior. He is a very pleasant man. Hyde and Wrinkle soon ran larger LSD-25 tests on student volunteers at Boston Psychopathic. The CIA caught wind of the study's unusual results and was eager to fund the operation. For them, a drug like this was valuable for far more than studying mental illness. They might develop a truth serum or find a way to reprogram minds. In 1953, Wrinkle and Hyde began receiving grants from one of the CIA's fronts, the Society for the Investigation of Human Ecology. Soon, hundreds of students from Harvard, Emerson, and MIT were unwittingly assisting the agency's research into the possibility of mind control. The subjects knew they were receiving something called LSD, and that reactions would range from pleasant to unpleasant, but nothing prepared them for how otherworldly, surreal, or ego-crushing the experience might be. "We lost a couple," Philip Slater, one of Wrinkle's assistants, told author Don Latton. "One had to be hospitalized. Another went out in the street to see if cars were real." None of those involved in the experiments had the proper training or understanding to guide participants through what could be a positive, life-changing moment. In 1994, Dr. Robert Reed told the Globe that he was aware of at least one death associated with the program. "They gave this patient LSD one morning, and when I came back from lunch that day, I was told she had hung herself in the downstairs bathroom." It wasn't all a horror show. One of the earliest subjects was Latvian-born painter Hyman Bloom, an important artist in the Boston Expressionism movement. Bloom may have been the first artist anywhere to experiment with LSD's effect on creativity, and undoubtedly the first to do so in the United States. He was asked to draw two portraits of Wrinkle, one at the beginning of the trip and another at the peak of the experience. The result was beautifully abstract. "He lost himself making dots and dashes," Wrinkle told the Globe, which reproduced the drawings in the paper in 1965. Intelligence Agency Director Alan Dulles described the CIA's efforts as a battle for men's minds. It was rumored that the Soviets were working day and night on brain perversion techniques. So to compete, Dulles authorized a secret operation called MK-Ultra. The objective was mind control, and LSD was just one of the possible keys, along with isolation, verbal abuse, and hypnosis. Once again, the agency turned to Boston for assistance, in the form of Henry A. Murray, a Harvard professor who researched psychological screening tests and brainwashing techniques. Subjects submitted a short essay explaining their personal philosophy. Upon arriving the next day, they would be escorted into a harshly lit room where a young lawyer tore their belief system apart. Murray designed the entire experience to be surprising and brutalizing. One test subject, Theodore Kaczynski, later became infamous as the Unabomber, sending a series of deadly bombs over a period of 17 years. The FBI forensic psychiatrist who examined Kaczynski reported that the young student began having nightmares and concocting revenge fantasies around the time of Murray's experiment, and even worried about the possibility of mind control. Despite rumors that Murray gave his subjects LSD, there is no evidence of this, and Kaczynski denied it. As Murray's tests continued in 1959, a dazzling new lecturer arrived on campus. Timothy Leary, a 39-year-old Massachusetts native, was a wunderkind in the field of psychology, author of a 1957 book, The Interpersonal Diagnosis of Personality. Relatively straight when he first arrived at Harvard, Leary was permanently altered in the summer of 1960 after consuming 7 of the sacred mushrooms of Mexico during a trip to Cuernavaca. By the end of the night, Leary was reborn. "It was the classic visionary voyage," he wrote in 1968. "You are never the same after you've had that one flash glimpse down the cellular time tunnel. You are never the same after you've had the veil drawn. Back at Harvard, Leary wrote Sandoz, requesting hallucinogens for academic research. We expected to receive a long form back that had to be filled out and signed by various people, Leary's assistant, George Litwin, recalled. Instead, what came in the mail was a large bottle of psilocybin pills with a little note that said, "Good luck in your research. Let us know your findings." Murray was interested in hallucinogenics, but hearing about Leary's recent experiences with magic mushrooms convinced him to experiment himself. It even seemed like a professional advantage. Leary declared that he learned more about psychology in his 5-hour Mexican mushroom trip than in his preceding 15 years of research. With Murray and others swayed by Leary's enthusiasm, the school approved the Harvard psilocybin project. He was now sanctioned to administer doses to students. The trips differed from those at Boston Psychopathic by emphasizing a supportive environment. Not only did you take LSD, but LSD also took you. If you were in a paranoid state under hospital lights, the trip would likely be horrific. If the tripper took the time to adjust her set, current mental state, and setting, physical location, before swallowing the pill, the chances for a positive experience grew exponentially. Richard Alpert first spotted his colleague Timothy Leary working in a tiny office he had built himself in what had formerly been a closet. They became drinking buddies, and soon taught a course together called Existential Transactional Behavior Change. Leary invited Alpert, 10 years his junior, to be part of the Harvard psilocybin project. During his first trip, Alpert saw the versions of himself that he had groomed over the years. Then these social constructs peeled away, leaving only a place where I existed independent of social and physical identity. Alpert wanted everyone to feel this same sense of pure being. We gave psilocybin to jazz musicians and physicists and philosophers and ministers and junkies and graduate students and social scientists, he later wrote. Only 3% transcended all form and saw just pure energy, a homogeneous field. It has been called the white light. As the son of a prominent Boston attorney, Alpert had always been on the fast track to professional success. He had already been a visiting professor at Berkeley before arriving at Harvard. Impressive for a man not yet 30. "Before I got involved with Tim, I was leading a shady life," he later said. "I was a professor and I was cruising parks and men's rooms." In Cambridge, he hosted dinner parties in his antique-filled apartment. He drove a Mercedes-Benz and flew a Cessna. "I was living the way a successful bachelor professor is supposed to live in the American world." Psilocybin made him realize something was wrong. It was a hustle. Despite Alpert's upstanding reputation, Harvard still fretted over the project. The study courted controversy, which reached a fever pitch in 1962, as papers ran headlines like, "Harvard Eats the Holy Mushroom, Religious Visions Produced by Dangerous Brain Drugs." The chairman of the psychology department announced that any participating students would be dropped from the PhD program. The details of how Harvard fired Richard Alpert, thus shuttering the Harvard psilocybin project, are not flattering to any of the parties involved. Leary and Alpert had promised the administration that they would not give any undergraduates the hallucinogenic pill. But Alpert made an exception for an attractive student named Ronnie Winston. Winston's friend and former roommate, Andrew Weil, was also desperate to try psilocybin. But Leary and Alpert turned him down. Weil pressured Ronnie Winston for details about the experience, then published an exposé in the Harvard Crimson. The school fired Alpert in May 1963. Yes, that Andrew Weil. Dr. Andrew Weil has one of the most recognizable faces in wellness. You've definitely seen him and his signature bushy white beard, whether on his PBS series, the covers of bestsellers like Spontaneous Healing, or as a guest on Oprah. Before he got famous, his writing led to the firing of Alpert and Leary. Then, in 1968, he found himself in their shoes. Shortly before arriving at Harvard, where he would study ethnobotany and become a Crimson editor, Weil read an article about a college student who died of a mescaline overdose while in search of inspiration for a creative writing class. A phrase in the piece, "galaxies of exploding colors," captured Weil's imagination. "I resolved to devote my ingenuity to getting and trying mescaline," he wrote. At Harvard, Weil and Winston lobbied Leary for a dose. Leary declined but gave tantalizing descriptions of what these chemicals offered. "It is exhilarating. It shows us that the human brain possesses infinite possibilities. It can operate in space-time dimensions that we never dreamed even existed." Writing on Harvard stationery, Weil found a company willing to ship him mescaline directly and soon started blasting off his classmates. He required everyone to write up a report of their experience, like a miniature version of the school's sanctioned psychedelics project. As Weil was playing Leary Jr. in his dorm, Richard Alpert broke his promise to the university and gave Ronnie Winston psilocybin. When Weil found out, he not only glimpsed Alpert's hypocrisy, but felt personally rejected. Soon he was working with both the Crimson and the administration to expose the psilocybin project, even as his own mescaline experiments continued. Weil's betrayal had a silver lining for Alpert and Leary. Both men became instant heroes of the counterculture. Weil enrolled at Harvard Medical School, where he wanted to conduct a legitimate, properly controlled study of marijuana and bust the myths surrounding it. Studying the medical literature about any drug with any scandalous associations, he discovered only a vast collection of rumor, anecdote, and second-hand accounts. It wasn't until his final year of medical school in 1968 that this became possible. Just barely. Joe Atteri, Boston's so-called pot lawyer and one of Avatar's defenders, bet Weil that he would never receive approval for the experiment. Harvard was especially strict because of the psilocybin project's demise, which Weil himself had brought about 5 years earlier. The threat of drug-related lawsuits loomed large. But in another irony, Weil's role in the Leary-Alpert debacle helped push the experiment through. "I got some minutes of the debate of the Harvard Medical School group that had to approve it, and there were actually statements that I was the one blowing the whistle on Alpert and Leary," he says. "That was one of the reasons that they agreed to let it go forward." In a twist that Philip K. Dick would savor, the pot study was greenlit, in part because Weil had been a narc. Harvard didn't make it easy, telling Weil he couldn't give the drug to people who had never tried it before. Weil balked. His entire experiment required marijuana-naive subjects. It was the only way to standardize SET, Weil notes. He began looking for pot virgins in his circle of friends and, failing that, took out ads in the local papers. It took 2 months of interviewing prospective volunteers to come up with 9 men from the student population of Boston who had never tried marijuana. Throughout, Harvard badgered Weil, threatening to deny him academic credit if he strayed from their guidelines. They wouldn't let it be done on their premises or any affiliated institutions, and they wouldn't let their students be used as subjects, Weil says. He felt so attacked, he even reached out to his old nemesis. "I'm in the same situation you were in," Weil told Richard Alpert over the phone. Science published Weil's marijuana study in December 1968. It made the front page of the New York Times, "so I think people were impressed," he recalls. The findings were simple. elucidating things anyone who has ever smoked a joint would recognize, but that wasn't the point. The experiences offered by marijuana and more potent drugs were nearly impossible to quantify scientifically, but many of their supposed dangers found their way into print. Weil's work was a response to anti-drug propaganda that appeared in newspapers regularly, with headlines like, "Baby's Deformity Blamed on LSD." The Science publication launched Weil's writing career, but it seems he may have been publishing in other publications at the same time, under a pseudonym. According to editor Wayne Hansen, a short-lived Avatar column, The Illuminated Pharmacologist was Weil's work under an assumed name. Sure enough, consulting the issues in question, there are two lengthy pieces written by one William Andrews, with a tone and content nearly identical to Weil's other writing at the time. The bio even describes him as a fourth-year medical student in psychopharmacology living in Boston. Weil remembers Avatar and the Fort Hill community, but does not recall writing for the underground paper. Instead, he says, he wrote a critical piece on the community for the Harvard Crimson. Attempts to locate that particular article were unsuccessful, but Weil described it as such. "I was over there a couple times and talked to people, but you know, I was very peripherally involved and I saw a little bit." It really was a cult around Mel Lyman. I'm not sure I knew quite what to make of it. Richard Alpert wouldn't become a spiritual leader until 1968, but by 1963, he had a following. After his firing from Harvard, his research was now limited to 23 Kenwood Avenue in Newton. Richard Alpert looked around at all the people suddenly living in and visiting his house, artists, socialites, madmen, and even Leary's children, and mindfully noted that a cult was forming. "We were a cult turned inward," he would later say. The core group comprised Alpert, Ralph Metzner, Tim's children Susan and Jack Leary, and heiress Peggy Hitchcock, supplemented with an impressive roster of visitors, including Allen Ginsberg, Charles Mingus, and William Burroughs. Alpert's Newton neighbors had never seen anything like it. Cars coming and going at all hours, rock music blasting from open windows. The city council heard complaints. The Boston Herald announced, "Big Family Stirs Protest. Men do the dishes in Newton Commune." The entire operation picked up stakes and moved to a mansion owned by Peggy Hitchcock's family, a vast estate in Millbrook, New York, which Ralph Metzner later described as an ever-changing scene of magic and creativity. But internal disputes would eventually rip apart the community, and Alpert ditched the scene, more confused than ever. Disillusioned with Leary, Millbrook, and to an extent hallucinogens too, he decided to seek answers outside the culture he was raised in. Alpert wanted to find out if Eastern holy men could tell him what LSD actually was. He spent 3 months wandering the Middle East with a bottle of the drug before landing in Nepal with full-blown depression. His attempts to have spiritual masters decode LSD had failed. He kept trying to explain his interesting backstory to his guide, Bhagwan Das, who would respond, "Don't think about the past. Just be here now." Bhagwan Das led Alpert to a valley in the shadow of the Himalayas, where they found a small man in his 60s wrapped in a blanket, surrounded by a small group of followers. Bhagwan Das fell at the feet of Neem Karoli Baba. Alpert expected to be disappointed. Then the guru told him that he, Alpert, had been thinking of his mother, who had died from a bloated stomach the night before. It was true. Spellbound, the ex-Harvard professor burst into tears. "Maharaji indicated he wanted to try LSD," Alpert said. "I didn't know if that was wise because he was old. One pill would have been enough for a person like me. He took all the pills at once. Nothing happened. He didn't have any reaction. He was saying, "It's in you." For Albert, this was the first time he witnessed someone take acid and emerge believing that godliness remained inherently inside the self. No drug necessary. Maharaji christened him Ram Das, servant of God. Months passed, his beard grew. "You make many people laugh in America?" Maharaji asked him one day. It was time to go home. When he stepped off the plane at Logan Airport in late 1968, he didn't resemble the man who had departed for India the year before. Barefoot and bearded and wearing a robe, he didn't even have the same name. Home at last, Ram Das just wanted to sort of be by myself in a cabin on my father's farm and just live like I lived in India. But driving his father's Cadillac to pick up some groceries in a small New Hampshire town, he ran into some kids trying to score acid. Ram Das asked why they were asking. "Well, we see a Cadillac from Massachusetts and a guy that looks like you, and we assumed. We were waiting for a connection to come into town. We assumed you're it." "I'm not that kind of connection anymore," Ram Das told the kids. "Well," one of them said, confused, "what kind of connection are you?" They listened, rapt, as he described his experiences in India. They came to the house, and then they brought their friends, and then they brought their parents and the ministers, and the whole thing developed until pretty soon 200 to 300 people were coming every weekend just to hang out and talk about spirit and stuff like that, Ram Das said. The family felt that, to some extent, it was an invasion of our privacy, William Alpert, his brother, admitted in the documentary Ram Das, Fierce Grace. On the other hand, we realized that Richard was doing a very good thing here. I know my mother-in-law, for example, was absolutely in love with him. She said, "Whenever you have him over the house, please let me be there. I just find it so peaceful to be with him." The press delighted in the story of the notorious Harvard drug prof turned guru. Reporter Robert Taylor followed Ram Das around for a Globe profile, initially planning to unveil a fraud. Instead, he found one of the most engaging, lucid, and extraordinary persons I ever encountered, and I am still deeply stirred by his splendid human qualities. At Harvard, I was a good guy, then a bad guy, then a bad good guy, Ram Das told him. Now I'm almost back to being a good guy again. As LSD usage skyrocketed in the United States, fewer users kept tabs on set and setting. Many didn't know the dosage of what they were ingesting, or if it was even LSD in the first place. The backlash over psychedelics grew until 1966, when Senator Thomas J. Dodd called for a Senate subcommittee to look into regulating the drug. Leary was brought in as an expert witness. Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy went on the attack, asking him to detail the drug's harmful effects. "Sir, the motor car is dangerous if used improperly," Leary told the subcommittee. "Human stupidity and ignorance is the only danger human beings face in this world." The New York Times headline made it sound like Leary was against his own cause. Leary sees crisis in use of LSD. "The key to your work is advertising," media critic Marshall McLuhan advised him over lunch, after hearing his less-than-stellar testimony. "You're promoting a product, the new and improved accelerated brain. You must use the most current tactics for arousing consumer interest. Associate LSD with all the good things that the brain can produce." From now on, he always had to smile when in public. Wave reassuringly, radiate courage, never complain or appear angry, You must be known for your smile. It worked. The image of a smiling Leary, even when handcuffed, is what most people remember to this day. All he needed now was a slogan, which he landed on a few days later while taking a shower. Turn on, tune in, drop out. Leary's